prince of Fluda. The bard, too, had been borne to earth under the paws of another wolf. Ilanwe still stood, though a third animal crouched in front of her. Taran's hand flew to his sword. The grey wolf seized his arm. The animal's teeth, however, did not sink into his flesh, but held him in an unshakable grip. At the end of the ravine, a huge, robed figure suddenly appeared. Melengar stood behind him. The man raised his arm and spoke a command. Immediately, the wolf holding Taran relaxed his jaws and drew away, as obediently as a dog. The man strode toward Taran, who scrambled to his feet. "You saved our lives," Taran began. "We are grateful." The man spoke again to the wolves, and the animals crowded around him, whining and wagging their tails. He was a strange-looking figure, broad and muscular, with the vigor of an ancient but sturdy tree. His white hair reached below his shoulders, and his beard hung to his waist. Around his forehead he wore a narrow band of gold, set with a single blue jewel. "From these creatures," he said, in a deep voice that was stern but not unkind, "your lives were never in danger. But you must leave this place. It is not an abode for the race of men."
"We were lost," Taran said. "We had been following our horse."
"Melengar?" The man turned a pair of keen grey eyes on Taran. Under his deep brow they sparkled like frost in a valley. "Melengar brought me four of you? I understood young Gergi was alone. By all means, then, if you are friends of Melengar." "It is Melengar, isn't it? She looks so much like her mother, and there are so many I cannot always keep track of the names."
"I know who you are," cried Taran. "You are Medwin."
"Am I now?" the man answered with a smile that furrowed his face. "Yes, I have been called Medwin. But how should you know that?"
"I am Taran of Caer Dalbyn. Gwydion, Prince of Don, was my companion, and he spoke of you before his death. He was journeying to Caer Dathil, as we are now. I never hoped to find you."
"You were quite right," Medwin answered. "You could not have found me. Only the animals know my valley. Melengar led you here."
"Taran, you say, of Caer Dalbyn?" He put an enormous hand to his forehead.
"Let me see. Yes, there are visitors from Caer Dalbyn, I am sure."
Taran's heart leapt. "Henwen," he cried.
Medwin gave him a puzzled glance. "Were you seeking her? Now that is curious. No, she is not here."
"But I had thought—"
"We will speak of Henwen later," said Medwin. "Your friend is badly injured, you know. Come, I shall do what I can for him."
He motioned for them to follow. The wolves padded silently behind Taran, Ilanwe, and the bard. Where Melengar waited at the end of the ravine, Medwin lifted Gergi from the saddle, as if the creature weighed no more than a squirrel. Gergi lay quietly in Medwin's arms. The group descended a narrow footpath. Medwin strode ahead, as slowly and powerfully as if a tree were walking. The old man's feet were bare, but the sharp stones and pebbles did not trouble him. The path turned abruptly, then turned again. Medwin passed through a cut in a bare shoulder of the cliff, and the next thing Taran knew, they suddenly emerged into a green, sunlit valley. Mountains, seemingly impassable, rose on all sides. Here the air was gentler without the tooth of the wind. The grass spread rich and tender before him. Set among tall hemlocks were low white cottages, not unlike those of Caer Dalbyn. At the sight of them, Taran felt a pang of homesickness. Against the face of the slope behind the cottages, he saw what appeared at first to be rows of moss-covered tree trunks. As he looked, to his surprise, they seemed more like the weather-worn ribs and timbers of a long ship. The earth covered them almost entirely. Grass and meadow flowers had sprung up to obliterate them further and make them part of the mountain itself.
"I must say, the old fellow is well tucked away here," whispered Fluda. "I could never have found the path in, and I doubt I could find the path out."
Taran nodded. The valley was the most beautiful he had ever seen. Cattle grazed peacefully in the meadow. Near the hemlocks, a small lake caught the sky and sparkled blue and white. The bright plumage of birds flashed among the trees. Even as he stepped across the lush green of the turf, Taran felt exhaustion drain from his aching body.
"There's a fawn!" Ailanwy cried with delight.
From behind the cottages, a speckled, long-legged fawn appeared, sniffed the air, then trotted quickly toward Medwin. The graceful creature paid no attention to the wolves, but frisked gaily at the old man's side. The animal drew shyly away from the strangers, but her curiosity got the better of her, and soon she was nuzzling Ailanwy's hand.
"I've never seen a fawn this close," said the girl. "Akran never had any pets. None that would stay with her, at any rate. I can't blame them at all. This one is lovely. It makes you feel all tingly, as if you were touching the wind."
Medwin, motioning for them to wait, carried Gergi into the largest of the cottages. The wolves sat on their haunches and watched the travellers through slanted eyes. Taran unsaddled Melengar, who began cropping the tender grass. Half a dozen chickens clucked and pecked around a neat white henhouse. The rooster raised his head to show a notched comb.
"Those are Dalwyn's chickens," cried Taran. "They must be. There's the brown hen, the white. I'd know that comb anywhere."
He hurried over and clucked at them. The chickens, more interested in eating, paid little attention. Medwin reappeared in the doorway. He carried an enormous wicker basket laden with jugs of milk, with cheese, honeycombs, and fruits that, in the lowlands, would not be in season for another month.
"I shall look after your friend directly," he said. "Meantime, I thought you might enjoy—" "Oh, yes, so you've found them, have you?" he said, noticing Taran with the chickens. "Those are my visitors from Caer Dalben. There should be a swarm of bees, too, somewhere about."
"They flew away," Taran said, "the same day Henwen ran off."
"Then I imagine they came straight here," Medwin said. "The chickens were petrified with fright. I could make no sense at all out of them. Oh, they settled down quickly enough, but of course by that time they had forgotten why they flew off in the first place. You know how chickens are, imagining the world coming to an end one moment, then pecking corn the next. They shall all fly back when they're ready, have no fear, though it's unfortunate Dalwyn and Carl should be put out in the matter of eggs." "I would ask you inside," Medwin continued, "but the disorder at the moment. There were bears at breakfast, and you can imagine the state of things. So I must ask you to attend to yourselves. If you would rest, there is straw in the byre. It should not be too uncomfortable for you."
The travellers lost no time in helping themselves to Medwin's provisions or in finding the byre. The sweet scent of hay filled the low-ceilinged building. They scooped out nests in the straw, uncovering one of Medwin's breakfast guests curled up and fast asleep. Fluda, at first uneasy, was finally convinced the bear had no appetite for bards, and soon began snoring. Ailanwy dropped off to sleep in the middle of one of her sentences. Taran had no desire to rest. Medwin's valley had refreshed him more than a night's slumber. He left the byre and strolled across the meadow. At the far side of the lake, otters built a slide and were amusing themselves by tumbling down it. At Taran's approach, they stopped for a moment, raised their heads to look at him as though sorry he was unable to join them, and returned to their game. A fish broke water in a twinkle of silver scales. The ripples widened until the last of them lapped gently at the shore. Medwin, Taran saw, had gardens of both flowers and vegetables behind the cottage. To his surprise, Taran found himself yearning to work with Carl in his own vegetable plot. The weeding and hoeing he had so despised at Caer Dalben now seemed, as he thought of his past journey and the journey yet to come, infinitely pleasant. He sat down by the rim of the lake and looked across the hills. With the sun resting above the peaks, the wooden skeleton of the great ship stood out sharply against the mound which nearly enveloped it. He had little chance to study it, for Medwin appeared, walking deliberately across the field. The fawn trotted beside him, the three wolves followed. With his brown robe and white hair, Medwin looked as broad and solid as a snow-capped mountain.
"Gergi is more comfortable than he was,"
the ancient man said in his deep voice. The fawn danced at the lake shore, while Medwin ponderously sat down and leaned his huge head toward Taran.
"He will recover well. There is no longer any danger. Not, at least, while he is here.
I have thought long of Gergi, Taran said, looking frankly into the old man's grey eyes. He explained then the reason for his journey, and the events leading to Gergi's accident. Medwin listened carefully, head cocked to one side, thoughtful, while Taran recounted Gergi's willingness to sacrifice his own life, rather than endanger the others.
At first, I wasn't too fond of him, Taran admitted. Now I've begun to like him in spite of all his whining and complaining.
Every living thing deserves our respect, said Medwin, knitting his shaggy brows. Be it humble or proud, ugly or beautiful.
I wouldn't want to say that about the Gwythaints, Taran answered.
I feel only sorrow for those unhappy creatures, Medwin said. Once, long ago, they were as free as other birds, gentle and trusting. In his cunning, Aron lured them to him and brought them under his power. He built the iron cages, which are now their prison house in Anuvin. The tortures he inflicted on the Gwythaints were shameful and unspeakable. Now they serve him out of terror. Thus he would strive to corrupt every animal in Prydain, no less than the race of men. That is one of the reasons I remain in the valley. Here, Aron cannot harm them. Even so, were he to become ruler of this land, I doubt I could help them all. Those who fell into his clutches would be counted fortunate if they perished quickly.
Taran nodded. I understand more and more why I must warn the sons of Don. As for Gergi, I wonder if it wouldn't be safer for him to stay here.
Safer? Asked Medwin. Yes, certainly. But you would hurt him grievously were you to turn him away now. Gergi's misfortune is that he is neither one thing nor the other at the moment. He has lost the wisdom of animals, and he has not gained the learning of men. Therefore, both shun him. Were he to do something purposeful, it would mean much to him. I doubt he will delay your journey, for he will be able to walk as well as you, by tomorrow, easily. I urge you to take him. He may even find his own way of serving you. Neither refuse to give help when it is needed, Medwin continued, nor refuse to accept it when it is offered. Gwythir, son of Greidawl, learned that from a lame ant, you know.
A lame ant?
Taran shook his head. Dalban has taught me much about ants, but nothing of a lame one.
It is a long history, Medwin said. Perhaps you will hear all of it another time. For the moment, you need only know that when Killock, or was it his father? No, it was young Killock. Very well. When young Killock sought the hand of the fair Olwen, he was given a number of tasks by her father, Ispadadan. He was chief giant at the time. What the tasks were does not concern us now, except that they were very nigh impossible. And Killock could not have accomplished them without the aid of his companions. One of the tasks was to gather 9 bushels of flax seed, though there was scarcely that much in all the land. For the sake of his friend, Gwythir, son of Greidawl, undertook to do this. While he was walking over the hills, wondering how he might accomplish it, he heard a grievous wailing from an anthill. A fire had started around it, and the ants were in danger of their lives. Gwythir, yes, I'm quite sure it was Gwythir, drew his sword and beat out the fire. In gratitude, the ants combed every field until they had collected the 9 bushels. Yet the chief giant, a picky and disagreeable sort, claimed the measure was not complete. 1 flax seed was missing, and must be delivered before nightfall. Gwythir had no idea where he could find another flax seed, but at last, just as the sun had begun to set, up hobbled a lame ant, carrying a heavy burden. It was the single flax seed, and so the last measure was filled. I have studied the race of men, Medwin continued. I have seen that alone you stand as weak reeds by a lake. You must learn to help yourselves, that is true, but you must also learn to help one another. Are you not, all of you, lame ants?
Taran was silent. Medwin put his hand into the lake and stirred the water. After a moment, a venerable salmon rippled up.
Medwin stroked the jaws of the huge fish.
"What place is this?" Taran finally asked, in a hushed voice.
"Are you indeed Medwin?
You speak of the race of men as if you were not one of them."
"This is a place of peace," Medwin said, "and therefore not suitable for men, at least not yet. Until it is, I hold this valley for creatures of the forests and the waters. In their mortal danger they come to me, if they have the strength to do so, and in their pain and grief. Do you not believe that animals know grief and fear and pain? The world of men is not an easy one for them."
"Dalban," said Taran, "taught me that when the black waters flooded Prydain ages ago, Nevid Navnevian built a ship and carried with him two of every living creature. The waters drained away, the ship came to rest, no man knows where. But the animals who came safe again into the world remembered, and their young have never forgotten. And here," Taran said, pointing toward the hillside, "I see a ship far from water. Gwydion called you Medwin, but I ask—"
"I am Medwin," answered the white-bearded man, "for all that my name may concern you. That is not important now. My own concern is for Henwen."
"You have seen nothing of her, then?"
Medwin shook his head.
"What Lord Gwydion said is true. Of all places in Prydain, she would have come here first, especially if she sensed her life in danger. But there has been no sign, no rumor. Yet she would find her way, sooner or later, unless—"
Taran felt a chill ripple at his heart. "Unless she's been killed," he murmured. "Do you think that has happened?"
"I do not know," Medwin answered, "though I fear it may be so."
Chapter 14. The Black Lake. That night, Medwin prepared a feast for the travellers. The disorder left by the breakfasting bears had been cleared away. The cottage was snug and neat, though even smaller than Caer Dalban. Taran could see that Medwin was indeed unused to entertaining human visitors, for his table was barely long enough to seat them all. And for chairs, he had been obliged to make do with benches and milking stools. Medwin sat at the head of the table. The fawn had gone to sleep, but the wolves crouched at his feet and grinned happily. On the back of his chair perched a gigantic, golden-plumed eagle, watching every movement with sharp, unblinking eyes. Fluda, though still apprehensive, did not allow his fear to affect his appetite. He ate enough for three, without showing the least sign of becoming full. But when he asked for another portion of venison, Medwin gave a long chuckle and explained to the amazed Fluda it was not meat at all, but vegetables prepared according to his own recipe.
"Of course it is," Ilan, we told the bard. "You wouldn't expect him to cook his guests, would you? That would be like asking someone to dinner and then roasting him. Really, I think bards are as muddled as assistant pig-keepers. Neither one of you seems to think very clearly."
As much as he welcomed food and the chance to rest, Taran was silent throughout the meal, and continued so when he retired to his nest of straw. Until now, he had never imagined Henwen might not be alive. He had spoken again with Medwin, but the old man could give him no assurance. Wakeful, Taran left the byre and stood outside, looking at the sky. In the clear air, the stars were blue-white, closer than he had ever seen them. He tried to turn his thoughts from Henwen. Reaching Caer Dathil was the task he had undertaken, and that in itself would be difficult enough. An owl passed overhead, silent as ashes. The shadow, appearing noiselessly beside him, was Medwin.
"Not asleep?" Medwin asked. "A restless night is no way to begin a journey."
"It is a journey I'm eager to end," Taran said. "There are times when I fear I shall not see Caer Dalban again."
"It is not given to men to know the ends of their journeys," Medwin answered. "It may be that you will never return to the places dearest to you. But how can that matter, if what you must do is here and now?"
"I think," said Taran longingly, "that if I knew I were not to see my own home again, I would be happy to stay in this valley."
Your heart is young and unformed, Medwin said. Yet if I read it well, you are of the few I would welcome here. Indeed, you may stay if you choose. Surely you can entrust your task to your friends.
No, said Taran, after a long pause. I have taken it on myself through my own choice.
If that is so, answered Medwin, then you can give it up through your own choice.
From all over the valley, it seemed to Taran there came voices urging him to remain. The hemlocks whispered of rest and peace. The lake spoke of sunlight lingering in its depths, the joy of otters at their games. He turned away.
No, he said quickly. My decision was made long before this. Then, Medwin answered gently, so be it.
He put a hand on Taran's brow.
I grant you all that you will allow me to grant. A night's rest. Sleep well.
Taran remembered nothing of returning to the byre or falling asleep, but he rose in the morning sunlight, refreshed and strengthened. Ailanwy and the bard had already finished their breakfast, and Taran was delighted to see that Gurgi had joined them. As Taran approached, Gurgi gave a yelp of joy and turned gleeful somersaults.
Oh, joy! He cried. Gurgi is ready for new walkings and stalkings. Oh, yes! And new seekings and peekings, great lords have been kind to happy, jolly Gurgi.
Taran noticed Medwin had not only healed the creature's leg, he had also given him a bath and a good combing. Gurgi looked only half as twiggy and leafy as usual. In addition, as he saddled Melingar, Taran found that Medwin had packed the saddlebags with food and had included warm cloaks for all of them. The old man called the travellers around him and seated himself on the ground.
"The armies of the Horned King are by now a day's march ahead of you," he said. "But if you follow the paths I shall reveal, and move quickly, you may regain the time you have lost. It is even possible for you to reach Caer Dathil a day, perhaps two, before them. However, I warn you, the mountain ways are not easy. If you prefer, I shall set you on a path toward the Valley of Istrad once again."
"Then we would be following the Horned King," Taran said. "There would be less chance of overtaking him, and much danger, too."
"Do not think the mountains are not dangerous," Medwin said, "though it is danger of a different sort."
"A Flam thrives on danger," cried the bard. "Let it be the mountains or the Horned King's hosts. I fear neither."
"Not to any great extent," he added quickly. "We shall risk the mountains," Taran said.
"For once," Ailanwy interrupted, "you decided the right thing. The mountains certainly aren't going to throw spears at us, no matter how dangerous they are. I really think you're improving."
"Listen carefully, then," Medwin ordered.
As he spoke, his hands moved deftly in the soft earth before him, moulding a tiny model of hills, which Taran found easier to follow than Fluda's map scratchings. When he finished, and the traveller's gear and weapons were secured on Melingar's back, Medwin led the group from the valley. As closely as Taran observed each step of the way, he knew the path to Medwin's valley would be lost to him as soon as the ancient man left. In a little while, Medwin stopped.
"Your path now lies to the north," he said, "and here we shall part. And you, Taran of Caer Dalban, whether you have chosen wisely, you will learn from your own heart. Perhaps we shall meet again, and you will tell me. Until then, farewell."
Before Taran could turn and thank Medwin, the white-bearded man disappeared, as if the hills had swallowed him up, and the travellers stood by themselves on a rocky, wind-swept plateau.
"Well,"
said Fluda, hitching up the harp behind him,
"I somehow feel that if we meet any more wolves, they'll know we're friends of Medwin."
The first day's march was less difficult than Taran had feared. This time he led the way, for the bard admitted, after a number of harp strings had snapped, that he had not been able to keep all Medwin's directions in his head. They climbed steadily until long after the sun had turned westward, and though the ground was rough and broken, the path Medwin had indicated lay clearly before them. Mountain streams, whose water ran cold and clear, made winding lines of sparkling silver as they danced down the slopes into the distant valley lands. The air was bracing, yet with a cold edge, which made the travellers grateful for the cloaks Medwin had given them. At a long cleft protected from the wind, Taran signalled a halt. They had made excellent progress during the day, far more than he had expected, and he saw no reason to exhaust themselves by forcing a march during the night. Tethering Melengar to one of the stunted trees that grew in the heights, the travellers made camp. Since there was no further danger from the Cauldronborn, and the hosts of the Horned King moved far below and to the west of the group, Taran deemed it safe to build a fire. Medwin's provisions needed no cooking, but the blaze warmed and cheered them. As the night shadows drifted from the peaks, Ailanwë lit her golden sphere and set it in the crevice of a faulted rock. Gergi, who had not uttered a single moan or groan during this part of the journey, perched on a boulder and began scratching himself luxuriously, although, after Medwin's washing and combing, it was more through habit than anything else. The bard, as lean as ever despite the huge amount he had eaten, repaired his harp strings.
"You've been carrying that harp ever since I met you," Ailanwë said, "and you've never once played it. That's like telling somebody you want to talk to them, and when they get ready to listen, you don't say anything."
"You'd hardly expect me to go strumming out airs while those cauldron warriors were following us," Fluda said. "Somehow I didn't think it would be appropriate. But a flam is always obliging, so if you really care to hear me play," he added, looking both delighted and embarrassed. He cradled the instrument in one arm, and almost before his fingers touched the strings, a gentle melody, as beautiful as the curve of the harp itself, lifted like a voice singing without words. To Taran's ear, the melody had its own words, weaving a supple thread among the rising notes. "Home, home," they sang. And beyond the words themselves, so fleeting he could not be quite sure of them, were the fields and orchards of Caer Dalbyn, the gold afternoons of autumn, and the crisp winter mornings with pink sunlight on the snow. Then the harp fell silent. Fluda sat with his head bent close to the strings, a curious expression on his long face.
"Well, that was a surprise," said the bard at last. "I had planned something a little more lively, the sort of thing my war leader always enjoys, to put us in a bold frame of mind, you understand."
"The truth of the matter is," he admitted with a slight tone of discouragement, "I don't really know what's going to come out of it next. My fingers go along, but sometimes I think this harp plays of itself."
"Perhaps," Fluda continued, "that's why Taliesin thought he was doing me a favor when he gave it to me. Because when I went up to the Council of Bards for my examination, I had an old pot one of the minstrels had left behind, and I couldn't do more than plunk out a few chants. However, a flam never looks a gift horse in the mouth, or in this case, I should say harp."
"It was a sad tune," Ailanwë said. "But the odd thing about it is, you don't mind the sadness. It's like feeling better after you've had a good cry. It made me think of the sea again, though I haven't been there since I was a little girl."
At this, Taran snorted, but Ailanwë paid no attention to him.
"The waves break against the cliffs and churn into foam, and farther out, as far as you can see, there are the white crests, the white horses of Lyr, they call them. But they're really only waves waiting their turn to roll in."
"Strange," said the bard. "Personally, I was thinking of my own castle. It's small and draughty, but I would like to see it again. A person can have enough wandering, you know. It made me think I might even settle down again and try to be a respectable sort of king."
"Caer Dalbyn is closer to my heart," Taran said. "When I left, I never gave it too much thought. Now I think of it a great deal." Gergi, who had been listening silently, set up a long howl.
"Yes, yes, soon great warriors will all be back in their halls, telling their tales with laughings and chaffings. Then it will be the fearful forest again for poor Gergi to put down his tender head in snoozings and snorings."
"Gergi," Taran said, "I promise to bring you to Caer Dalbyn, if I ever get there myself. And if you like it, and Darwin agrees, you can stay there as long as you want.
What joy! Gurgi cried. Honest, toiling Gurgi extends thanks and best wishes. Oh, yes, fond, obedient Gurgi will work hard.
For now, obedient Gurgi had better sleep, Taran advised, and so should we all. Medwin has put us well on our way, and it can't take much longer. We'll start again at daybreak. During the night, however, a gale rose, and by morning a drenching rain beat into the cleft. Instead of slackening, the wind gained in force and screamed over the rocks. It beat like a fist against the traveller's shelter, then pried with searching fingers, as if to seize and dash them into the valley. They set out, nevertheless, holding their cloaks before their faces. To make matters worse, the path broke off entirely, and sheer cliffs loomed ahead of them. The rain stopped after the travellers had all been soaked to the skin, but now the rocks were slippery and treacherous. Even the sure-footed Melingar stumbled once, and for a breathless moment Taran feared she would be lost. The mountains swung a half-circle around a lake black and sullen below threatening clouds. Taran halted on an outcropping of stone and pointed toward the hills at the far side of the lake. "According to what Medwin told us," he said to the bard, "we should make for that notch, all the way over there. But I see no purpose in following the mountains when we can cut almost straight across. The lake shore is flat at least, while here it's getting practically impossible to climb." Fluder rubbed his pointed nose. "Even counting the time it would take us to go down and come up again, I think we should save several hours. Yes, I definitely believe it's worth trying."
"Medwin didn't say a word about crossing valleys," Ailanwy put in.
"He didn't say anything about cliffs like these," answered Taran. "They seem nothing to him. He's lived here a long time. For us it's something else again."
"If you don't listen to what somebody tells you," Ailanwy remarked, "it's like putting your fingers in your ears and jumping down a well. For an assistant peakkeeper who's done very little travelling, you suddenly know all about it."
"Who found the way out of the barrow?" Taran retorted. "It's decided. We cross the valley." The descent was laborious, but once they had reached ground level, Taran felt all the more convinced they would save time. Holding Melingar's bridle, he led the group along the narrow shore. The lake reached closely to the base of the hills, obliging Taran to splash through the shallows. The lake, he realized, was not black in reflection of the sky. The water itself was dark, flat, and as grim and heavy as iron. The bottom, too, was as treacherous as the rocks above. Despite his care, Taran lurched and nearly got a ducking. When he turned to warn the others, to his surprise, he saw Gurgi in water up to his waist and heading toward the center of the lake. Fluder and Ailanwy were also splashing farther and farther from land.
"Don't go through the water," Taran called. "Keep to the shore."
"Wish we could," the bard shouted back. "But we're stuck somehow. There's a terribly strong pull."
A moment later, Taran understood what the bard meant. An unexpected swell knocked him off his feet, and even as he put out his hands to break his fall, the black lake sucked him down. Beside him, Melingar thrashed her legs and whinnied. The sky spun overhead. He was pulled along like a twig in a torrent. Ailanwy shot past him. He tried to regain his footing and catch her. It was too late. He skimmed and bobbed over the surface. The far shore would stop them, Taran thought, struggling to keep his head above the waves. A roar filled his ears. The middle of the lake was a whirlpool, clutching and flinging him to the depths. Black water closed over him, and he knew he was drowning.
Chapter 15. King Idileg. Down he spun, battling for air, in a flood that broke upon him like a crumbling mountain. Faster and faster the waters bore him along, tossing him right and left. Taran collided with something. What it was he could not tell, but he clung to it, even as his strength failed him. There was a crash, as though the earth had split asunder. The water turned to foam, and Taran felt himself dashed against an unyielding wall. He remembered nothing more. When he opened his eyes, he was lying on a hard, smooth surface,
his hand tightly gripping Fluda's harp. He heard the rush of water close by. Cautiously, he felt around him. His fingers touched only wet, flat stone, an embankment of some kind. A pale blue light shone high above him. Taran decided he had come to rest in a cave or grotto. He raised himself, and his movement set the harp to jangling.
"Hello! Who's that?"
A voice echoed down the embankment. Faint though it was, Taran recognized it as belonging to the bard. He scrambled to his feet and crept in the direction of the sound. On the way he tripped over a form which became suddenly vocal and indignant.
"You've done very well, Taran of Caer Dalban, with all your shortcuts. What's left of me is soaked to the skin, and I can't find my bauble. Oh, here it is, all wet, of course. And who knows what's happened to the rest of us?"
The golden light flared dimly to reveal the dripping face of Ailanwy, her blue eyes flashing with vexation. Gurgi's hairy, sputtering shadow rolled toward them.
"Oh, poor tender head is filled with sloshings and washings."
In another moment Fluda had found them. Melengar whinnied behind him.
"I thought I heard my harp down here," he said. "I couldn't believe it at first. Never expected to see it again, but a flam never despairs. Quite a stroke of luck, though."
"I never thought I'd see anything again," Taran said, handing the instrument to Fluda. "We've been washed into a cave of some kind, but it's not a natural one. Look at these flagstones."
"If you'd look at Melengar," Ailanwy called, "you'd see all our provisions are gone, all our weapons, too, thanks to your precious shortcut."
It was true. The straps had broken loose, and the saddle had torn away in the whirlpool. Luckily, the companions still had their swords. "I'm sorry," Taran said. "I admit we are here through my fault. I should not have followed this path. But what's done is done. I led us here, and I'll find a way out." He glanced around. The roar of water came from a wide, swift-running canal. The embankment itself was much broader than he had realized. Lights of various colors glowed in the high arches. He turned to his companions again. "This is very curious. We seem to be deep underground, but it isn't the lake bottom." Before he could utter another word, he was seized from behind, and a bag smelling strongly of onions was jammed over his head. Ailanwy screamed, then her voice grew muffled. Taran was being half-pushed, half-pulled, in two directions at once. Gurgi began yelping furiously.
"Here, get that one,"
a gruff voice shouted.
"Get him yourself. Can't you see I've got my hands full?"
Taran struck out. A solid, round ball that must have been someone's head butted him in the stomach. There were slapping noises filtering through the oniony darkness around him. Those would be from Ailanwy. Now he was pushed from behind, propelled at top speed, while angry voices shouted at him and at each other.
"Hustle along there!" "You fool! You didn't take the swords!"
At this came another shriek from Ailanwy, the sound of what might have been a kick, then a moment of silence.
"All right, let them keep the swords. You'll have the blame of it, letting them approach King Adilig with weapons."
At a blind trot, Taran was shoved through what seemed a large crowd of people. Everyone was talking at once. The noise was deafening. After a number of turns, he was thrust forward again. A heavy door snapped behind him. The onion bag was snatched from his head. Taran blinked. With Fluda and Ailanwy, he stood in the center of a high vaulted chamber, glittering with lights. Gurgi was nowhere in sight. Their captors were half a dozen squat, round, stubby-legged warriors. Axes hung from their belts, and each man had a bow and quiver of arrows on his shoulder. The left eye of the short, burly fellow who stood beside Ailanwy was turning greenish-black. Before them, at a long stone table, a dwarfish figure with a bristling yellow beard glared at the warriors. He wore a robe of garish red and green. Rings sparkled on his plump fingers.
"What's this?"
he shouted.
"Who are these people? Didn't I give orders I wasn't to be disturbed?" "But, Majesty," began one of the warriors, shifting uneasily, "we caught them. Must you bother me with details?"
King Adileg cried, clasping his forehead.
"You'll ruin me. You'll be the death of me. Out! Out! No, not the prisoners, you idiots!"
Shaking his head, sighing and sputtering, the king collapsed onto a throne carved from rock. The guards scurried away. King Idil shot a furious glance at Taran and his companions.
"Now then, out with it. What do you want? You might as well know ahead of time. You shan't have it."
"Sire," Taran began, "we ask no more than safe passage through your realm. The four of us..."
"There's only three of you,"
King Idilig snapped.
"Can't you count?"
"One of my companions is missing," Taran said regretfully. He had hoped Gergi would have overcome his fear, but he could not blame the creature for running off after his ordeal in the whirlpool. "I beg your servants to help us find him. Then, too, our provisions and weapons have been lost."
"That's clotted nonsense," shouted the king. "Don't lie to me. I can't stand it."
He pulled an orange kerchief from his sleeve and mopped his forehead.
"Why did you come here?"
"Because an assistant pig-keeper led us on a wild goose chase,"
Ilanwe interrupted.
"We don't even know where we are, let alone why. It's worse than rolling downhill in the dark."
"Naturally," said Idilig,
his voice dripping with sarcasm.
"You have no idea. You're in the very heart of the kingdom of Tylwyth Teg. The fair folk, the happy family, the little people, or whatever other insipid, irritating names you've put on us. Oh, no, of course not. You just happened to be passing by."
"We were caught in the lake," Taran protested. "It pulled us down."
"Good, eh?"
King Idilig answered, with a quick smile of pride.
"I've added some improvements of my own, of course."
"If you're so anxious to keep visitors away," Ilanwe said, "you should have something better, to make people stay out."
"When people get this close," Idilig answered, "they're already too close. At that point, I don't want them out, I want them in."
Fluda shook his head.
"I always understood the fair folk were all over Prydain, not just here."
"Of course not just here," said Idilig with impatience. "This is the royal seat. Why, we have tunnels and mines every place you can imagine, but the real work, the real labour of organisation, is here, right here, in this very spot, in this very throne room. On my shoulders. It's too much, I tell you, too much.
But who else can you trust?
If you want something done right..."
The king stopped suddenly and drummed his glittering fingers on the stone table.
"That's not your affair," he said. "You're in trouble enough as it is. It can't be overlooked."
"I don't see any work being done," said Ilanwe.
Before Taran could warn Ilanwe not to be imprudent, the door of the throne room burst open, and a crowd of folk pressed in. Looking closer, Taran saw not all were dwarfs. Some were tall, slender, with white robes. Others were covered with glistening scales like fish. Still others fluttered large, delicate wings. For some moments Taran heard nothing but a confusion of voices, angry outcries and bickering, with Idilig trying to shout above them. Finally the king managed to push them all out again.
"No work being done,"
he cried.
"You don't appreciate everything that goes into it. The Children of Evening, that's another ridiculous name you humans have thought up, are to sing in the Forest of Cantref Mor tonight. They haven't even practiced. Two are sick, and one can't be found. The lake sprites have been quarrelling all day. Now they're sulking. Their hair's a mess.
And who does that reflect on?
Who has to jolly them along, coax them, plead with them? The answer is obvious. What thanks do I get for it?"
King Idilig ranted on.
"None at all. Has any of you long-legged gawks ever taken the trouble, even once, mind you, to offer the simplest expression of gratitude, such as, 'Thank you, King Idilig, for the tremendous effort and inconvenience you've gone to, so that we can enjoy a little charm and beauty in the world above, which would be so unspeakably grim without you and your fair folk. Just a few words of honest appreciation.' By no means. Just the opposite. If any of you thick-skulled oafs come on one of the fair folk above ground, what happens? You seize him, you grab him with your great hammy hands, and you try to make him lead you to buried treasure. Or you squeeze him until you get three wishes out of him, not satisfied with
Oh, no, but three. Well, I don't mind telling you this,
Idyllic went on, his face turning redder by the moment.
I've put an end to all this wish-granting and treasure-scavenging. No more. Absolutely not. I'm surprised you didn't ruin us long ago.
Just then a chorus of voices rose from behind the door of Idyllic's throne room. The harmonies penetrated even the walls of heavy stone. Taran had never in his life heard such beautiful singing. He listened, enchanted, forgetting for the moment all but the soaring melody. Idyllic himself stopped shouting and puffing until the voices died away.
"That's something to be thankful for,"
the king said at last.
"The children of evening have evidently got together again. Not as good as you might want, but they'll manage somehow."
"I have not heard the songs of the fair folk until now," Taran said. "I had never realized how lovely they were."
"Don't try to flatter me,"
Idyllic cried, trying to look furious, yet beaming at the same time. "What surprises me?" Ailanwy said, while the bard plucked meditatively at his harp, trying to recapture the notes of the song. "Is why you go to so much trouble. If you fair folk dislike all of us above ground, why do you bother?"
"Professional pride, my dear girl,"
said the Dwarf King, putting a chubby hand to his heart and bowing slightly.
"When we fair folk do something, we do it right. Oh, yes."
He sighed. "Never mind the sacrifices we make. It's a task that needs doing, and so we do it. Never mind the cost. For myself," he added with a wave of his hand, "it doesn't matter. I've lost sleep, I've lost weight, but that's not important."
If King Idyllic had lost weight, Taran thought to himself, what must he have been like beforehand? He decided against asking this question.
"Well, I appreciate it," Ailanwy said. "I think it's amazing what you've been able to do. You must be extremely clever, and any assistant pig-keepers who happen to be in this throne room might do well to pay attention."
"Thank you, dear girl," said King Idyllic, bowing lower. "I see you're the sort of person one can talk to intelligently. It's unheard of for one of you big shambling louts to have any kind of insight into these matters. But you at least seem to understand the problems we face."
"Sire," interrupted Taran, "we understand your time is precious. Let us disturb you no more. Give us safe conduct to Cair Dathil."
"What?" shouted Idyllic. "Leave here? Impossible. Unheard of. Once you're with the fair folk, my good lad, you stay, and no mistake about it. Oh, I suppose I could stretch a point for the sake of the young lady and let you off easily. Only put you to sleep for 50 years, or turn you all into bats. But that would be a pure favour, mind you."
"Our task is urgent," Taran cried. "Even now we have delayed too long."
"That's your concern, not mine,"
Idyllic shrugged. "Then we shall make our own way," Taran shouted, drawing his sword. Fluda's blade leapt out, and the bard stood with Taran, ready to fight.
"More clotted nonsense,"
King Idyllic said, looking contemptuously at the swords pointed toward him. He shook his fingers at them.
"There, and there. Now you might try to move your arms."
Taran strained every muscle. His body felt turned to stone.
"Put your swords away, and let's talk this over calmly," said the Dwarf King, gesturing again. "If you give me any decent reason why I should let you go, I might think it over and answer you promptly, say in a year or two."
There could be no use, Taran saw, in concealing the reasons for his journey. He explained to Idyllic what had befallen them. The Dwarf King ceased his blustering at the mention of Aron, but when Taran had finished, King Idyllic shook his head.
"This is a conflict you, great gawks, must attend to yourselves. The fair folk owe you no allegiance,"
he said angrily.
"Prydain belonged to us before the race of men came. You drove us underground. You plundered our mines, you blundering clodpoles. You stole our treasures, and you keep on stealing them, you clumsy oaves."
"Sire," Taran answered, "I can speak for no man but myself. I have never robbed you, and I have no wish to. My task means more to me than your treasures. If there is ill will between the fair folk and the race of men, then it is a matter to be settled between them. But if the Horned King triumphs, if the shadow of Anuvin falls on the land above you, Aron's hand will reach your deepest caverns.
For an assistant pig-keeper, said Ideleg,
you're reasonably eloquent.
But the fair folk will worry about Aron when the time comes.
The time has come, Taran said. I only hope it has not passed.
I don't think you really know what's going on above ground, Alanby suddenly exclaimed. You talk about charm and beauty and sacrificing yourself to make things pleasant for people. I don't believe you care a bit for that. You're too conceited and stubborn and selfish.
Conceited? Shouted Ideleg, his eyes popping. Selfish? You won't find anyone more open-hearted and generous. How dare you say that? What do you want? My life's blood?
With that he tore off his cloak and threw it in the air, pulled the rings from his fingers and tossed them in every direction.
Go ahead! Take it all! Leave me ruined! What else do you want? My whole kingdom? Do you want to leave? Go, by all means. The sooner the better. Stubborn? I'm too soft. It'll be the death of me. But little you care.
At that moment the door of the throne room burst open again. Two dwarf warriors clung frantically to Gergi, who swung them about as if they were rabbits.
Joyous greetings. Faithful Gergi is back with mighty heroes. This time valiant Gergi did not run. Oh, no, no. Brave Gergi fought with great whackings and smackings. He triumphed, but then mighty lords are carried away. Clever Gergi goes seeking and begging to save them, yes, and he finds them. But that is not all. Oh, faithful, honest, fearless Gergi finds more. Surprises and delights, oh joy!
Gergi was so excited that he began dancing on one foot, spinning around and clapping his hands.
Mighty warriors go to seek a piggy. It is clever, wise Gergi who finds her.
And when? Cried Taran. Where is she?
Here, mighty lord, Gergi shouted. The piggy is here!
Chapter 16 Doli. Taran turned accusingly to King Ideleg.
You said nothing of Henwen.
You didn't ask me, said Ideleg.
That's sharp practice, Fluda muttered, even for a king.
It's worse than a lie, Taran said angrily. You'd have let us go our way, and we'd never have known what happened to her.
You should be ashamed of yourself,
Ailanwy put in, shaking her finger at the king, who appeared most embarrassed at being found out.
It's like looking the other way when someone's about to walk into a hole.
Finders keepers, the dwarf king snapped. A troop of the fair folk came on her near the Avron banks. She was running through a ravine. And I'll tell you something you don't know. Half a dozen warriors were after her, the henchmen of the Horned King. The troop took care of those warriors. We have our own ways of dealing with you clumsy lummoxes. And they brought your pig here, underground most of the way.
No wonder Gwydion could find no tracks, Taran murmured to himself.
The fair folk rescued her, Ideleg angrily continued, turning bright red. And there's another fine example. Do I get a word of thanks? Naturally not. But I do get called disagreeable names and have nasty thoughts thrown at me. Oh, I can see it in your faces. Ideleg is a thief and a wretch. That's what you're saying to yourselves. Well, just for that you shan't have her back. And you'll stay here, all of you, until I feel like letting you go.
Ailanwy gasped with indignation.
If you do that, she cried, you are a thief and a wretch. You gave me your word. The fair folk don't go back on their word.
There was no mention of a pig. No mention at all.
Ideleg clapped his hands over his paunch and snapped his mouth shut. No, Taran said, there was not. But there is a question of honesty and honour. Ideleg blinked and looked sideways. He took out his orange kerchief and mopped his brow again.
Honour, he muttered. Yes, I was afraid you'd come to that. True, the fair folk never break the word. Well, he sighed,
That's the price for being open-hearted and generous. So be it. You shall have your pig.
We shall need weapons to replace those we lost, Taran said.
What?
Screamed Adilag.
Are you trying to ruin me?
And crunchings and munchings,
piped up Gurgi. Taran nodded. Provisions as well.
This is going too far,
Adilag shouted.
You're bleeding me to death. Weapons, food, pigs.
And we beg for a guide who will show us the way to Kaer Dathil. At this, Adilag nearly exploded. When finally he calmed himself, he nodded reluctantly.
I shall lend you Dolly, he said. He is the only one I can spare.
He clapped his hands and gave orders to the armed dwarfs, then turned to the companions.
Off with you now, before I change my mind.
Ailanwy stepped quickly to the throne, bent and kissed Adileg on the top of his head.
Thank you, she whispered. You're a perfectly lovely king.
Out! Out!
The dwarf cried. As the stone door closed behind him, Taran saw King Adileg fondling his head and beaming happily. The troop of fair folk led the company down the vaulted corridors. Taran had at first imagined Idileg's realm to be no more than a maze of underground galleries. To his astonishment, the corridors soon broadened into wide avenues. In the great domes far overhead, gems glittered as bright as sunshine. There was no grass, but deep carpets of green lichen stretched out like meadows. There were blue lakes, glistening as much as the jewels above, and cottages and small farmhouses. It was difficult for Taran and his companions to realize they were underground.
"I've been thinking," whispered Fluda, "that it might be wiser to leave Henwen here until we can return for her."
"I thought of that too," answered Taran. "It's not that I don't trust Adileg to keep his word, most of the time, but I'm not sure we should take another chance in that lake, and I doubt we could find another way into his kingdom. He certainly won't make it easy for us to come back, I'm afraid. No, we must take Henwen while we have the chance. Once she's with me again, I won't let her out of my sight." Suddenly the fair folk halted at one of the cottages, and from a neatly carpentered pen Taran heard a loud,
"Wench!"
He raced to the sty. Henwen was standing with her front feet on the rails, grunting at the top of her voice. One of the fair folk opened the gate, and the white pig burst out, wriggling and squealing. Taran threw his arms around Henwen's neck. "Oh, Hen," he cried, "even Medwin thought you were dead."
"Witch! Ha!"
Henwen chuckled joyfully. Her beady eyes sparkled. With her great pink snout she rooted affectionately under Taran's chin and came close to knocking him down.
"She looks like a wonderful pig,"
Ailanwy said, scratching Henwen behind the ears.
"It's always nice to see two friends meet again. It's like waking up with the sun shining."
"She's certainly a great deal of pig," agreed the bard, "though very handsome, I must say."
"And clever, noble, brave, wise Gurgi found her."
"Have no fear," Taran said with a smile to Gurgi. "There's no chance we'll forget it." Rolling and waddling on her short legs, Henwen followed Taran happily, while the fair folk proceeded across the fields to where a stocky figure waited. The captain of the troop announced that this was Dolly, the guide Adileg had promised. Dolly, short and stumpy, almost as broad as he was tall, wore a rust-colored leather jacket and stout knee-high boots. A round cap covered his head, but not enough to conceal a fringe of flaming red hair. An axe and short sword hung from his belt, and over his shoulder he wore the stubby bow of the fair folk warrior. Taran bowed politely. The dwarf stared at him with a pair of bright red eyes and snorted. Then, to Taran's surprise, Dolly took a deep breath and held it until his face turned scarlet and he looked about to burst. After a few moments, the dwarf puffed out his cheeks and snorted again. "What's the trouble?" asked Taran.
"You can still see me, can't you?"
Dolly burst out angrily.
"Of course I can still see you."
Taran frowned.
"Why shouldn't I?"
Dolly gave him a scornful look and did not answer. Two of the fair folk led up Melengar. King Idileg, Taran saw with relief, was as good as his word. The saddlebags bulged with provisions, and the white mare also carried a number of spears, bows, and arrows, short and heavy.